The flowers are so beautiful there, in the courts of the House of Maidens.
She was silent for a moment.
A message was sent to Morgaine at Avalon.
A message was sent, Mother.
But Taliesin told us Morgaine hadn't been seen in Avalon, said Guinevere. No doubt she is with Queen Morgause in Lothian, and in these times it takes forever for a messenger to come and go.
Igraine drew a heavy sigh and began to struggle with a cough again, and Guinevere helped her to sit upright. After a time, Igraine murmured,
Yet the sight should have bidden Morgaine to come to me. You would come if you knew your mother was dying, would you not?
Yes, for you came, and I'm not even your own mother.
Why has Morgaine not come?
It is nothing to her that I have come, Guinevere thought. It is not me she wants here. There is no one who cares whether I am here or elsewhere. And it seemed as if her very heart was bruised. But Igraine was looking at her expectantly, and she said,
Perhaps Morgaine has received no message. Perhaps she has gone into a convent somewhere and become a Christian and renounced the sight.
It may be so. I did so when I married Uther, Igraine murmured. Yet now and again it thrust itself on me undesired. And I think if Morgaine was ill or dying, I would know it.
Her voice was fretful.
The sight came upon me before you were married.
Tell me, Guinevere, do you love my son?
Guinevere shrank from the sick woman's clear grey eyes. Could Igraine see into her very soul?
I love him well, and I am his faithful queen, lady.
Aye, I believe you are, and you are happy together.
Igraine held Guinevere's slender hands in her own for a moment and suddenly smiled.
Why, so you must be. And will be happier yet, since you are bearing his son at last.
Guinevere's mouth dropped open, and she stared at Igraine.
I didn't know.
Igraine smiled again, a tender and radiant smile, so that Guinevere thought,
Yes, I can believe it, that when she was young she was beautiful enough for Uther to cast aside all caution and seek her with spells and charms.
Igraine said,
It is often so, though you are not really so young. I'm surprised you've not already had a child.
It wasn't for lack of wanting.
No, nor praying for it either, lady, Guinevere said, so shaken that she hardly knew what she was saying.
Was the old queen falling into delirium? This was too cruel for jesting.
How? What makes you think I'm
with child?
Igraine said, I forgot. You have not the sight. It has deserted me for long, and long I renounced it. But as I say, it steals upon me unawares, and never has it played me false.
Guinevere began to weep, and Igraine, troubled, reached out her thin hand and laid it over the younger woman's.
Why, how is this that I give you good news and you weep, child?
Now she will think I do not want a child, and I cannot bear to have her think ill of me.
Guinevere said shakily,
Only twice in all the years I've been married have I had any cause to think myself pregnant. And then I carried the child only a month or two. Tell me, lady, do you?
Her throat closed, and she dared not speak the words.
Tell me, Igraine, shall I bear this child? Have you seen me then with Arthur's child at my breast?
What would her priest think of this compromise with sorcery? Igraine patted her hand.
I wish I might tell you more, but the sight comes and goes as it will. God grant it come to a good end, my dear.
It may be that I can see no more, because by the time your child is born, I shall not be here to see.
No, no, child, do not weep, she begged. I have been ready to leave this life ever since I saw Arthur wedded. I would like to see your son. I would like to hold a child of Morgaine's in my arms, should that day ever come. But Uther is gone, and it is well with my children. It may be that Uther waits for me beyond death, or the other children I lost at birth. And if they do not,
she shrugged,
I shall never know.
Igraine's eyes closed, and Guinevere thought, I have wearied her. She sat silent until the older woman slept, then rose and went quietly into the garden. She felt numbed. It had truly not seemed to her that she might be pregnant. If she'd thought anything at all about it, it was that the stress of travel had delayed her courses. For the first 3 years of her marriage, every time it had been late, she had thought herself with child. Then, in the year in which Arthur had been, first, away for the Battle of Celloden Wood, and the long campaign before it, then, wounded and too weak to touch her, the same pattern had persisted. And finally, she had realized that her monthly rhythms were inconstant. There was no way to keep track of them by the moon, for sometimes 2 or 3 months might pass with no sign. But now that Igraine had spoken, she wondered why she hadn't thought of this before. It never occurred to her to doubt the Queen. Something inside Guinevere said, Sorcery. And there was a small voice that persisted in reminding her, All these things are of the devil and have no place in this house of holy women. But something else said, How could it be wicked to tell me this? It was more, she thought, as when the angel was sent to Mary the Virgin to tell her of the birth of her son. And then for a moment Guinevere was struck with awe at her own presumption. And then she began softly to giggle at the incongruity of Igraine, old and dying, as an angel of God. At that moment the bell rang in the cloister for prayers, and Guinevere, though here as a guest and without obligation, turned and went into the sisters' chapel, kneeling in her accustomed place among the visitors. But she heard little of the service, for her whole heart and mind were caught up in the most fervent prayer of her entire life. It has come, the answer to all my prayers. Oh, thank you, God and Christ and our Blessed Lady. Arthur was wrong. It wasn't he who failed. There was no need. And once again she was filled with the paralyzing shame she had felt when he had said that thing to her, all but giving her leave to betray him. And what a wicked woman I was then that I could even have considered it. But now, in the very midst of her wickedness, God had rewarded her when she deserved it now. Guinevere raised her head and began to sing the Magnificat with the rest so fervently that the abbess raised her head and looked sharply at her. They do not know why I'm thankful. They do not know how much I have to be thankful for. But they do not know how wicked I was either, for I was thinking here in this holy place of the one I love. And then, even through her joy, suddenly it was like pain again. Now he will look upon me big with Arthur's child, and he will think me ugly and gross, and never look on me again with love and longing. And even through the joy in her heart, she felt small and cramped and joyless. Arthur gave me leave, and we could have had each other at least once, and now, never. 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 She put her face into her hands and wept behind them, silently, and no longer cared that the abbess was watching her. That night, Igraine's breathing was so laboured that she couldn't even lower her head to rest. She had to sit bolt upright, propped up on many cushions, to breathe at all, and she wheezed and coughed without end. The abbess gave her a draught of something which would clear the lungs, but it only made her queasy, she said, and she could take no more of it. Guinevere sat beside her, drowsing a little now and then, but alert whenever the sick woman stirred, to give her a sip of water, to shift her pillows so that she could find a little ease. There was only a small lamp in the room, but there was brilliant moonlight, and the night was so warm that the door stood open into the garden. And through it all there was the ever-present muffled sound of the sea beyond the garden, beating at the rocks.
Strange, Igraine murmured at last in a faraway voice. Never would I have thought I would come here to die. I remember how dreary I felt, how alone, when first I came to Tintagel, as if I'd come to the very end of the world. Avalon was so fair, so beautiful, so filled with flowers.
There are flowers here, Guinevere said,
but not like the flowers of my home. It is so barren here, so rocky, she said. Have you been in the island, child?
I was schooled in the convent on Ynyswytron, madam.
It is beautiful on the island, and when I travelled here over the moors, it was so high and barren and deserted, I was afraid.
Igraine made a weak movement toward her, and Guinevere took her hand and was alarmed by its coldness.
You are a good child, Igraine said, to come so far when my own children could not. I remember how you dread travelling, and now to come so far when you are pregnant.
Guinevere rubbed the icy hands between her own.
Do not tire yourself with talking, mother.
Igraine made a little sound like a laugh, but it got lost in a fit of wheezing.
Do you think it makes any difference now, Guinevere? I wronged you. Even on the very day you were wedded, I went to Taliesin and asked him, was there any honourable way for Arthur to get out of this marriage?
I didn't know. Why? It seemed to her that Igraine hesitated before answering, but she couldn't tell. Perhaps it was only that the other woman struggled for speech.
I know not. Perhaps it was that I thought you would not be happy with my son.
She struggled again with a fit of coughing so heavy that it seemed she would never get her breath. When she had quieted a little, Guinevere said,
Now you must talk no more, mother. Will you have me bring you a priest? Damn all priests, said Igraine clearly. I will have none of them about me. Oh, look not so shocked, child.
She lay still for a moment.
You thought me so pious that I retired to a convent in my last years. But where else should I have gone? Vivian would have had me at Avalon, but I could not forget it was she who had married me to Gaulois. Beyond that garden wall lies Tintagel, like a prison. A prison it was to me, indeed. Yet it was the only place I could call my own, and I felt I had won it by what I endured there.
Another long, silent struggle for breath. At last she said,
I wish Morgaine had come to me. She has the sight. She should have known I was dying.
Guinevere saw that there were tears in her eyes. She said gently, rubbing the icy hands which now felt as taut as cold claws, I'm sure she would come if she knew, dear mother.
I'm not so sure. I sent her from me into Vivian's hands. Even though I knew well how ruthless Vivian could be, that she would use Morgaine as ruthlessly as she used me, for the well-being of this land, and for her own love of power, Igraine whispered. I sent her from me because I felt it better, if it came to be a choice of evils, that she should be in Avalon and in the hands of the goddess, than in the hands of the black priests who would teach her to think that she was evil because she was a woman. Guinevere was deeply dismayed. She chafed the icy hands between her own and renewed the hot bricks at Igraine's feet. But the feet, too, were cold as ice, and when she rubbed them, Igraine said she couldn't feel them. She felt she must try again. Now, with your end near, do you not want to speak with one of Christ's priests, dear mother? I told you no, said Igraine. Or after all these years when I kept silent to have peace in my home, I might tell them at last what I truly felt about them. I loved Morgaine enough to send her to Vivian, that she at least might escape them. She began wheezing again. Arthur, she said at last, never was he my son. He was Uther's. Only a hope of the succession, no more. I loved Uther well, and I bore him sons because it meant so much to him that he should have a son to follow him. Our second son, he that died soon after his navel string was cut, him, I think, I might have loved for my own, as I loved Morgaine. Tell me, Guinevere, has my son reproached you that you have not yet borne him an heir?
Guinevere bent her head, feeling her eyes stinging with tears.
No, he has been so good. Never once has he reproached me.
He told me once that he had never fathered a son by any woman, though he had known many, so that perhaps the fault wasn't mine.
If he loves you for yourself, then he is a priceless jewel among men, said Igraine. And it is all the better if you can make him happy. Morgaine I loved because she was all I had to love. I was young and wretched. You can never know how unhappy I was that winter when I bore her, alone and far from home, and not yet full grown. I feared she would have become a monster because of all the hate I felt when I was bearing her. But she was the prettiest little thing, solemn, wise, like a fairy child. She and Uther only have I loved. Where is she, Guinevere? Where is she that she would not come to her mother when she's dying?
Guinevere said compassionately, no doubt she knows not that you are ill.
But the sight,
Igraine cried, moving restlessly on her pillow.
Where can she be that she does not see that I'm dying? Ah, I saw she was in deep trouble, even at Arthur's crowning, and yet I said nothing. I didn't want to know. I felt I had had enough grief, and said nothing when she needed me. Guinevere, tell me the truth. Did Morgaine have a child somewhere, alone and far from anyone who loved her? Has she spoken of this to you? Does she hate me, then, that she will not come to me even when I'm dying, only because I didn't speak out all my fears for her at Arthur's crowning? Oh, goddess! I put aside the sight to have peace in my home since Uther was a follower of the Christ. Show me where dwells my child, my daughter.
Guinevere held her motionless and said,
now you must be still, mother. It must be as God wills. You cannot call upon the goddess of the fiends here.
Igraine sat bolt upright. Despite her sick, swollen face, her blue lips, she looked on the younger woman in such a way that Guinevere suddenly remembered, she too is High Queen of this land.
"You know not what you speak,"
Igraine said, with pride and pity and contempt.
"The goddess is beyond all your other gods. Religions may come and go, as the Romans found, and no doubt the Christians will find after them. But she is beyond them all."
She let Guinevere lower her to her pillows and groaned.
"I would my feet could be warmed. Yes, I know you have hot bricks there. I cannot feel them. Once I read in an ancient book which Taliesin gave me of some scholar who was forced to drink hemlock. Taliesin says the people have always killed the wise. Even as the people of the far southlands put Christ to the cross, so this wise and holy man was forced to drink hemlock because the rabble and the king said he taught false doctrine. And when he was dying, he said that the cold crept upward from his feet. And so he died. I have not drunk of hemlock, but it is as if I had. And now the cold is reaching my heart."
She shivered and was still. And for a moment Guinevere thought she had ceased to breathe. No, the heart was still sluggishly beating. But Igraine didn't speak again, lying wheezing on her pillows. And a little before dawn the rasping breaths finally ceased. Chapter 11. Igraine was buried at midday, after a solemn service of mourning. Guinevere stood beside the grave, tears sliding down her face as the shrouded body was lowered into the open earth. Yet she couldn't properly mourn her mother-in-law. Her living here was all a lie. She was no true Christian. If it was true what they believed, then Igraine was even now burning in hell. And she couldn't bear that, not when she thought of all Igraine's kindness to her. Her eyes burned with sleeplessness and tears. The lowering sky echoed her vague dread, heavy, as if at any moment rain would fall on them. Here, within convent walls, she was safe. But soon she must leave the safety of this place, and ride for days over the high moors with the brooding menace of that open sky everywhere, hanging over her and over her child. Guinevere, shivering, clasped her hands across her belly, as if in a futile wish to protect the dweller there from the menace of that sky. "Why am I always so frightened?" Igraine was a pagan and lost to the tricks of the devil. "But I am safe. I call upon Christ to save me. What is there under God's heaven to be afraid of?" Yet she was afraid, with the same reasonless fear that seized on her so often. "I must not fear. I am High Queen of all Britain. The only other to bear that title sleeps here beneath the earth. High Queen, and bearing the son of Arthur. Why should I be afraid of anything in God's world?" The nuns finished their hymn, turning from the grave. Guinevere shivered again, clutching her cloak. Now she must take very good care of herself, eat well, rest much, make certain that nothing went amiss as it had done before. Secretly she counted on her fingers. If it had been that last time before she left... But no, her courses had not come upon her for more than 10 Sundays. She simply wasn't certain. Still, it was sure that her son would be born sometime about Eastertide. Yes, that was a good time. She remembered when her lady Melias had borne her son. It had been the darkest of winter, and the wind had howled outside like all the fiends waiting to snatch the soul of the newborn child. So nothing would suit Melias but that the priest must come down to the woman's hall and baptize her babe almost before it cried. No, Guinevere was just as well pleased that she would not lie in at the darkest days of winter. Yet to have the longed-for child, she would be content to bear it even at midwinter night itself. A bell tolled, and then the abbess came to Guinevere. She didn't bow. Temporal power, she had once said, was nothing here. But Guinevere was, after all, the High Queen, so she inclined her head with great courtesy and said,
"Will you be staying on with us here, my lady? We would be deeply honoured to keep you as long as you wish."
"Oh, if only I could stay. It's so peaceful here." Guinevere said with visible regret,
"I cannot. I must return to Carleon."
She couldn't delay telling Arthur her good news, the news of his son.
"The High King must hear of...
his mother's death," she said. Then, knowing what the woman wanted to hear, she added quickly, "Be sure I will tell him how kindly you treated her. She had everything she could wish for in the last days of her life."
"It was our pleasure. We all love the Lady Igraine," said the old nun. "Your escort shall be told and be ready to ride with you early in the morning, God willing, and send good weather."
"Tomorrow? Why not today?" Guinevere asked, then stopped. No, that would be insulting haste indeed. She hadn't realized she was so eager to tell her news to Arthur, to end for all time the silent reproach that she was barren. She laid her hand on the abbess's arm.
"You must pray for me much now, and for the safe birth of the High King's son."
"Is it so, lady?"
The abbess's lined face wrinkled up in pleasure at being the confidant of the queen.
"Indeed we shall pray for you. It will give all the sisters pleasure to think we are the first to say prayers for our new prince."
"I shall make gifts to your convent."
"God's gifts and prayers may not be bought for gold," the abbess said primly, but she looked pleased nevertheless.
In the room near Igraine's chamber, where she had slept these last nights, her serving woman was moving about, putting garments and gear into saddlebags. As Guinevere entered, she looked up and grumbled,
"It suits not well with the dignity of the High Queen, madam, to travel with only one servant. Why, any knight's wife would have as much. You should get you another from one of the houses here, and a lady to travel with you as well."
"Get one of the lay sisters to help you, then," said Guinevere. "But we shall travel all the more quickly if we are but few."
"I heard in the courtyard that there were Saxons landing on the southern shores," the woman grumbled. "It soon will not be safe to ride anywhere in this country."
"Don't be foolish," Guinevere said. "The Saxons on the southern shores are bound fast by treaty to keep peace with the High King's lands. They know what Arthur's legion can do. They found it out at Celloden Wood. Do you think they want more work for ravens? In any case, we will soon be back at Carleon, and at the end of summer we shall move the court to Camelot in the summer country. The Romans defended that fort against all the barbarians. It has never been taken. Even now Sir Kai is there, building a great hall fit for Arthur's round table, so that all the companions and kings may sit at meat together." As she had hoped, the woman was diverted.
"That is near your own old home, is it not, lady?"
"Yes. From the heights of Camelot, one may look a bowshot across the water and see my father's island kingdom." "Indeed, I went there in childhood once," she said, remembering how, when she was a little girl, even before she went to school with the nuns on Ynys Witron, she had been taken up to the ruins of the old Roman fort.
There had been little there then, except for the old wall, and the priest hadn't stinted to make this a lesson on how human glories faded away. She dreamed that night that she stood high on Camelot, but the mists drew in around the shore, so that the island seemed to swim in a sea of cloud. Across from them she could see the high tower of Ynys Witran, crowned with ringstones, although she knew well that the ringstones had been thrown down by the priests 100 years ago. And by some trick of the sight, it seemed that Morgaine stood on the tower and laughed at her, and mocked her, and she was crowned with a wreath of bare wicker withes. And then Morgaine was standing beside her on Camelot, and they looked out over all the summer country, as far as the Isle of the Priests, looking down over her own old home where her father, Leodegrance, was king, and over Dragon Island, shrouded in mist. But Morgaine was wearing strange robes and a high double crown, and she stood so that Guinevere couldn't quite see her, but only knew she was there. She said, "I am Morgaine of the fairies, and all these kingdoms will I give to you as their high queen, if you will fall down and worship me." Guinevere woke with a start, Morgaine's mocking laughter in her ears. The room was empty and silent, except for the heavy snores of her serving woman, in a pallet on the floor. Guinevere made the sign of the cross, and lay down to sleep again. But on the very edge of sleep, it seemed to her that she looked into the clear and moonlit waters of a pool, and instead of her own face, Morgaine's pale face was reflected back at her, crowned with wicker withes like the harvest dolls some of the peasant folk still made, and very far away. And again Guinevere had to sit up and make the sign of the cross before she could compose herself to sleep. It seemed all too soon that she was wakened, but then she had been so insistent they should set forth at the first light. She could hear the rain pounding on the roof as she put on her gown by lamplight. But if they stayed for rain in this climate, they should be here a year. She felt dull and queasy, but now she knew there was a good reason for that, and secretly patted her still flat stomach as if to reassure herself it was real. She had no desire to eat, but dutifully swallowed some bread and cold meats. She had a long ride before her. And if she had no mind to riding in the rain, at least it was likely that any Saxons or marauders would stay within doors as well. She was fastening the hood of her warmest cloak when the abbess entered. After a few formal words of thanks for the rich gifts made by Guinevere on her own behalf, and on Igraine's, the abbess came to the real business of this farewell visit.
"Who now reigns in Cornwall, lady?"
"Why, I'm not sure," said Guinevere, trying to remember. "I know the High King gave Tintagel to Igraine when he married, so that she might have a place of her own, and I suppose, after her, the Lady Morgaine, daughter of Igraine by the old Duke Gaulois. I know not even who is there now as castellan."
"Nor I," said the abbess. "Some serving man or knight of the Lady Igraine, I suppose. That is why I came to speak with you, madam. The castle Tintagel is a prize, and it should be tenanted, or there will be war in this countryside too. If the Lady Morgaine is married and comes here to live, all will be well. I suppose, I do not know the lady, but if she is Igraine's daughter, I suppose she is a good woman and a good Christian."
"You suppose wrong," Guinevere thought, and again it was as if she heard the mocking laughter from her dream. But she would not speak ill of Arthur's kinswoman to a stranger. The abbess said,
"Bear my message to Arthur the king, lady, that someone should come to dwell in Tintagel.
I have heard something of a rumour that ran about the countryside when Gaulois died, that he had a bastard son and some other kinfolk, and some of them might strive to conquer this country again. While Igraine dwelt here, all folk knew it was under Arthur's dominion, but now it would be well if the High King sent one of his best knights hither, perhaps married to the Lady Morgaine.
"I will tell Arthur," Guinevere said. And as she set out, she pondered this.
She knew little of statecraft, but she remembered that there had been chaos before Uther came to the crown, and again when he died, leaving no heir. She supposed something like that might befall if Cornwall was left with none to rule or keep good laws. Morgaine was queen of Cornwall, and should come hither to reign. And then she remembered what Arthur had once said, that his dearest friend should wed with his sister. Since Lancelot wasn't wealthy and had no lands of his own, it would be the right thing that they should come to reign together in Cornwall. And now I am to bear Arthur's son, it would be best to send Lancelot far from court, that I might never again look on his face, and think of him such thoughts as no wedded woman and no good Christian should think. And yet she couldn't bear to think of Lancelot wedded to Morgaine. Had there ever been so wicked a woman as she on the face of this wicked world? She rode with her face hidden in her cloak, not listening to the gossip of the knights who were her escort. But after a time she realized that they were passing by a village which had been burned. One of the knights asked her leave to stop a while, and went away to look for survivors. He came back looking grim.
"Saxons," he said to the others,
and bit the words off when he saw that the queen was listening.
"Don't be frightened, madam. They are gone. But we must ride as fast as we may, and tell Arthur of this. If we find you a faster horse, can you keep our pace?"
Guinevere felt her breath catch in her throat. They'd come up out of one of the deep valleys, and the sky arched high and open over them, filled with menace. She felt as some small thing must feel in the grass when the shadow of a hawk swoops over it. She said, and heard her voice thin and trembling like the voice of a very little girl, "I cannot ride faster now. I bear the child of the High King, and I dare not endanger him." Again it seemed as if the knight, he was Griflet, husband of her own waiting woman Melias, bit off his words, setting his jaw with a snap. He said at last, concealing his impatience,
"Then, madam, it were as well we should escort you to Tintagel, or to some other great house in this area, or back again to the convent, so that we may ride at speed and reach Caerleon before the dawn of tomorrow's day. If you are with child, you certainly cannot ride through the night. Will you let one of us escort you and your woman back to Tintagel, or to the convent again?"
"I would like it well to be within walls again, if there are Saxons in this country. But I must not be such a coward. Arthur must have news of his son."
She said stubbornly, "Cannot one of you ride on toward Caerleon, and the rest of you travel at my pace? Or cannot a messenger be hired to bear the word quickly?" Griflet looked as if he wanted to swear.
"I could not trust to any hired messenger in this country now, madam. And there are few of us, even for a peaceful country, barely enough to protect you." "Well, it must be as it will. No doubt Arthur's men have received the word already."
He turned away, his jaw white and set, and looked so angry that Guinevere wanted to call him back and agree to all he said. But she told herself firmly not to be so cowardly. Now, when she was to bear the royal son, she must behave herself like a queen and ride on with courage. And if I was at Tintagel, and the countryside was filled with Saxons, there would I remain until the war had ended and all the country at peace again. And it might be long. And if Arthur didn't even know I was with child, he might be content to let me dwell there for evermore. Why should he want to bring back a barren queen to his new palace at Camelot? Like enough he would listen to the counsel of that old druid who hates me, Taliesin, who is his grandsire, and put me away for some woman who could bear him a bouncing brat every 10 moons or so. But all will be well, once Arthur knows. It seemed as if the icy wind was sweeping across the high moors and into her very bones. After a time she begged them to stop again and get out the litter so that she might ride within it. The horse's motion jolted her so. Grifflet looked angry, and for a moment she thought he would forget his courtesy and swear at her. But he gave the orders, and she huddled gratefully inside the litter, glad of the slow pace and the closed flaps which closed out the frightening sky. Before dusk the rain stopped for a while, and the sun came out, low and slanting over the dismal moor.
"We will set up the tents here," Grifflet said. "Here on the moor at least we can see a long way. Tomorrow we should strike the old Roman road, and then we can travel faster."
And then he dropped his voice and said something to the other knights, which Guinevere couldn't hear. But she cringed, knowing he was angry at the slow pace at which they must travel. Yet everyone knew a breeding woman was more likely to miscarry if she rode a fast horse, and already twice she had miscarried a child. Did they want her to lose Arthur's son this time too? She slept poorly within the tent, the ground hard beneath her thin body, her cloak and blankets all damp, her body aching from the unaccustomed riding. But after a time she slept, despite the pouring rain that leaked through the tent, and was wakened by the sound of riders and a call. Grifflet's voice harsh and rough.
"Who rides there? Stand." "Is it you, Grifflet? I know your voice,"
came a cry out of the dark.
"It is Gawain, and I seek for your party. Is the queen with you?"
Guinevere threw her cloak over her nightdress and came out from the tent.
"Is it you, cousin? What do you hear?"
"I hope to find you still at the convent,"
said Gawain, sliding from his horse. Behind him in the darkness were other forms, 4 or 5 of Arthur's men, though Guinevere couldn't distinguish their faces.
"Since you are here, madam, I suppose Queen Igraine has departed this life."
"She died the night before last," Guinevere said, and Gawain sighed.
"Well, it is God's will," he said. "But the land is under arms, madam. Since you are here and so far on your way, I suppose you must continue on to Carleon. Had you still been at the convent, I was under orders to escort you, and such of the sisters as wished to seek protection, to Tintagel Castle, and bid you remain there until there was safety in the land."
"And now you may spare the journey,"
said Guinevere irritably. But Gawain shook his head. He said,
"Since my message is useless, and I suppose the sisters will wish to take shelter within their convent walls, I must ride on to Tintagel with news for all men sworn to Arthur to come at once. The Saxons are massing near the coast with more than 100 ships. Beacon signals were sent from the lighthouses. The legion is at Carleon, and all men are gathering. When the word came to Lothian, I rode at once to join Arthur, and Arthur sent me to Tintagel to bear word thither."
He drew breath.
"Not the Merlin self is more a messenger than I these 10 days. "And I told the queen," said Grifflet, "that she should remain at Tintagel, but now it is too late to return there. And with armies gathering on the roads, Gawain, perhaps you should escort the queen back to Tintagel."
"No," said Guinevere clearly. "I must return now. I'm not afraid to travel where I must."
Even more, If he was facing war again, Arthur would wish for the good news she bore. Gawain had already shaken his head impatiently.
"I cannot delay for any woman's riding, unless it were the Lady of the Lake herself, who can ride a day's journey with any man a horse. And you are but a sorry rider, madam.
Nay, I spoke not to anger you. No one expects that you should ride like a knight. But I cannot delay.
And the queen is breeding, and must travel at the slowest pace of all," Griflet told him with equal impatience. "Can some of your slowest riders be told to escort the queen, Gawain? And I ride on with you to Tintagel."
Gawain smiled.
"No doubt you wish to be at the heart of things, Griflet, but you have been given this task, and no one envies you," he said. "Can you find me a cup of wine and some bread? I will travel on through the night to be in Tintagel at sunrise. I have a message for Marcus, who is War Duke of Cornwall, and is to bring his knights. This may be the great battle Taliesin foretold, where we perish, or we drive the Saxons once and for all from this land. But every man must come and fight at Arthur's side.
Even some of the treaty troops will stand with Arthur now," said Griflet.
"Ride on if you must, Gawain, and God ride with you."
The two knights embraced.
"We will meet again when God wills, friend."
Gawain bowed to Guinevere. She reached out a hand to him and said, "A moment. Is my kinswoman Morgause well?"
"As ever, madam."
"And my sister-in-law, Morgaine? She is safe in Morgause's court, then?" Gawain looked startled.
"Morgaine? No, madam. I haven't seen my kinswoman Morgaine for many years. Certainly she has not visited Lothian, or so my mother said," he replied, courteous despite his impatience. "Now I must be off."
"God ride with you," she said, and stood watching as the men's hoofbeats thundered away in the night. "It is now so near dawn," she said. "Is there any reason to try to sleep more? Or should we break camp and ride on for Caerleon?" Griflet looked pleased.
"True. There will be little sleep for any in this rain," he said. "And if you can travel, lady, it would please me well to be on the road. God knows what we shall have to pass through before we reach Caerleon."
But as the sun rose over the moors, it was as if they rode through a land already struck silent by the war. It was the season when the farmers should be out in their fields, but although they passed several isolated hill farms, no sheep grazed, not a dog barked, nor any child came to watch them, and even along the Roman road there wasn't a single traveller. Guinevere, shivering, realised that the word had gone out to raise the countryside for war, and such as could do nothing had crept behind closed doors to hide from the armies of either side.
"Will it endanger my child to travel at this pace?"
Yet now it seemed a choice of evils: endanger herself and her child and Arthur's by this forced travel, or delay on the road, and perhaps fall into the hands of the Saxon armies. She resolved that Griflet should have no further cause to complain that she had delayed them. Yet as she rode, unwilling to take refuge within her litter lest he accuse her again of delaying him, it seemed that fear was hovering everywhere around her. It was near to sunset, and it had been a long day when they caught sight of the watchtower which Uther had built at Caerleon. The great crimson banner of the Pendragon floated from the heights, and Guinevere crossed herself as they passed beneath it. "Now all Christian men are to make a stand against the barbarians. Is it fitting that this sign of an ancient devil faith should serve to rally the armies of a Christian king?" Once indeed she had spoken of it to Arthur, and he had answered that he had sworn to his people that he would rule over them as the great dragon, Christian and non-Christian alike without favour, and had laughed, stretching out his arms with the barbarian serpents tattooed all along their length. She felt loathing for those serpents, symbols that no Christian man should bear. But he had been stubborn. "I bear them in sign of the king-making when I was given Uther's place in this land. We will speak no more of this lady." And nothing she had said could force him to discuss it with her, or to listen to what a priest might say on the subject.
"Priestcraft is one thing, and kingcraft is another, my Guinevere. I would that you should share all things with me, but you have no wish to share this, and so I may not speak of it to you. And as for the priests, it is none of their affair. Leave it, I say."
His voice had been firm, not angry, but still she had bent her head and said no more. Yet now, as she rode beneath the Pendragon banner, she trembled. If our son is to rule in a Christian land, is it fitting that Druid banner should fly above his father's castle? They rode slowly through the encamped armies in the plain before Caerleon. Some of the knights, who knew her well, came out and set up a cheer for their queen, and she smiled and waved to them. They rode beneath the banner of Lot and through the men of Lothian, northmen with pikes and long axes, wrapped in the crudely dyed clothes they wore. Over their camp flew the banner of the Morrigan, the great raven of war. Gawain's brother Gaheris came out from that camp and bowed to her, and walked beside Griflet's horse as they rode up toward the castle.
"Did my brother find you, Griflet? He had a message for the queen."
"He met us when we were already a day on the road," Guinevere said, "and it was easier to continue here."
"I'll come with you to the castle. All of Arthur's chosen companions are bidden to dine with the king," said Gaheris. Gawain was angry at being sent with messages. "Yet no one can ride so swiftly as my brother when he must. Your lady is here, Griflet, but she is readying herself and the child to go to the new castle. Arthur says all the women must go. They can be more easily defended there, and he can spare but few to defend them."
To Camelot!
Guinevere's heart sank. She had ridden all the way from Tintagel to give Arthur news of their child, and now would he pack her up and send her to Camelot? "I do not know that banner," said Griflet, looking at a golden eagle sculptured lifelike on a pole. It seemed very ancient. "It's a standard of North Wales," said Gaheris. "Uriens is here with Avaloch, his son. Uriens claims his father took this standard from the Romans more than 100 years ago."
"It may even be the truth."
"The men from Uriens' hills are strong fighters, though I would not say so in their hearing."
"And whose banner is that?" asked Griflet. But this time, though Gaheris turned to speak, it was Guinevere herself who answered. "That is the banner of my father, Leodegrance. The blue banner with the cross worked in gold. She herself, as a young maiden in the summer country, had helped her mother's women to embroider it for the king. It was said that her father had chosen this device after hearing a tale that one of the emperors of Rome had seen the sign of the cross in the sky before one of his battles. We should now be fighting beneath that sign, not the serpents of Avalon." She shivered, and Gaheris looked at her sharply.
"Are you cold, lady? We must ride on to the castle, Griflet. No doubt Arthur will be awaiting his queen." "You must be weary of riding, my queen," said Griflet, looking up kindly at her. "Now will you soon be in the hands of your women?"
And as they came closer to the doors of the castle, there were many of Arthur's companions whom she knew, who waved to her, and called to her in friendly, informal fashion. "Next year at this time," she thought, "they will come out to cheer their prince." A big, lurching man, huge and clumsy-footed in leather armour and a steel cap, came into the path of her horse. It was as if he stumbled, though he bowed to Guinevere, and she could see that it was deliberate, that he had put himself in her way like this.
"Madam, my sister," he said, "do you not know me?"
Guinevere frowned and stared at him, then after a moment recognized him.
"Is it you?"
"Malia Grant," he said. "I've come here to fight at our father's side, and your husband's my sister."
Griflet said with a friendly smile,
"I knew not that your father had a son, my queen, but all are welcome to fight under Arthur's standard. Perhaps you will speak for me to your husband, the king, my sister," said Malia Grant.
Guinevere, looking at him, felt a faint distaste run through her. He was an enormous man, almost a giant, and like so many huge men, he looked misshapen, as if one side of his body were somehow grown larger than the other. One eye was certainly larger than the other, and had a squint. Yet, trying to be fair, Guinevere thought the man's deformity was no fault of his, and she really knew nothing against him. Yet it was arrogance that he should call her sister before all these men, and now he had grasped her hand without leave, and made as if to kiss it. She clenched it into a fist and pulled it away. Trying to make her voice firm, she said, "No doubt when you merit it, Malia Grant, my father will speak for you to Arthur, and he will make you one of his knights. I am only a woman, and I have no authority to promise you that. Is my father here?"
"He's with Arthur within the castle," said Malia Grant sullenly. "And I'm like a dog out here with the horses."
Guinevere said firmly, "I cannot see that you have any claim to more than this, Malia Grant. He has given you a post at his side, for your mother was once a favourite of his."
Malia Grant said harshly, "All men in the country know as well as my mother that I am the king's son, his only living son. Sister, speak to our father for me."
She pulled away her hand from his repeated effort to seize it. "Let me go, Malia Grant. My father claims you are not his son, and how can I say anything else? I never knew your mother. This is between you and my father."
"But you must listen,"
said Malia Grant urgently, tugging at her hand. And Griflet thrust himself between them and said,
"Hear, hear, fellow, you can't talk to the queen like that, or Arthur will have your head on his platter at dinner time. I'm sure our lord and king will grant you what is right, and if you fight well for him at this battle, no doubt he'll be glad to have you among his companions. But you mustn't trouble the queen this way."
Malia Grant turned to face him, towering over Griflet, until the latter, though he was a tall, athletic young man, looked like a child. The giant said,
"Are you going to tell me what I can say to my own sister, you little popinjay?"
Griflet put his hand on his sword and said, "I was given the task of escorting my queen, fellow, and I'll do the task Arthur's given me to do. Get out of my path, or I'll force you to."
"You? With who else?"
sneered Malia Grant, bracing himself with an ugly sneer.
"I, for one," said Gaheris, standing quickly at Griflet's side.
Like Gawain, he was a big, sturdy man who would have made two of the slender Griflet.
"And I," said Lancelot from the darkness beyond them, striding quickly toward Guinevere's horse,
and she could have wept with relief.
Never had he looked more handsome to her than now, and though he was slender and slightly built, something in his presence made Malia Grant draw back. "Is this man annoying you, Lady Guinevere?"
She swallowed and nodded, and found to her dismay that she had no voice to speak. Malia Grant blustered.
"Who may you be, fellow?"
"Take care," said Gaheris. "Don't you know the Lord Lancelot?"
"'I'm Arthur's captain of horse,' said Lancelot, in his lazy, amused voice. "'And the Queen's champion. "'Have you anything to say to me?'
"'My business!'